We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. So, plenty as usual to cover, starting out with election-related news.
Yeah, there is a new candidate in the race for City Council Position 9, which Lorena Gonzalez currently holds, and she'll be vacating because she's running for mayor. Brianna Thomas, Gonzalez's chief of staff and senior policy advisor, is running with an endorsement from Gonzalez and from State Representative Joe Wynn. She's now considered, in my opinion, the leading progressive candidate in the race. She supports the jumpstart tax on business payrolls and increased hazard pay for grocery workers, which, by the way, is now in court being challenged by the Grocery Manufacturers Association and the grocery stores lobbying group, although it did actually go into effect, and the judge has not issued an injunction against it going into effect. So that's something the city may have to address if there's a decision in that case against the hazard pay for grocery workers. Brianna Thomas also supports budget cuts for the Seattle Police Department, although not abolishing the department, which is very similar to Lorena Gonzalez's positions. She does support expanding services to underserved communities of color, including investing in small minority-owned businesses. And she also recognizes the need to support Seattle's artistic community, which has been particularly hit hard by the double blow of both rising rents here in Seattle and the COVID-19 lockdown. In addition to working for Lorena Gonzalez for the past 5 years, Thomas has worked as a legislative aide in Olympia for State Senator Steve Hobbs and Bob Hasegawa. She also ran the successful campaigns for two initiatives, the Democracy Vouchers Initiative and the $15 an hour minimum wage for workers in SeaTac, which laid the groundwork for the $15 minimum wage here in Seattle and for other cities around the nation, with SeaTac being one of the first places in the country that passed the $15 an hour law. Overall, she looks like the best progressive option so far. But, you know, Nikita Oliver has been making noises in the past saying that they might jump into the race for this seat. But so far, they haven't made a decision yet. So we'll see if that actually happens.
That's the Seattle People's Party.
Yeah, they are the Seattle's People's Party. Now, for Council Position 8, the other citywide seat on the council, which is currently held by Teresa Mosqueda, and Mosqueda has already announced that she's going to run for re-election. Her only opponent so far is Mike McQuaid, which we've talked about in the past. He's the pro-business developer-friendly candidate who's sat on the South Lake Union Neighborhood Council. McQuaid was in the news this week when the Seattle Times reported that he had a past assault conviction. He pled to a deferred prosecution agreement, which led to the charges being dismissed in 2018 after he served a year of probation and 24 hours of service on a work crew. That's pretty typical for a first-time offender. So the question is, what did he actually do?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he had a disagreement with a landscaper at his Westlake condo. The two of them got into an argument, got face-to-face, and McQuaid apparently tried to headbutt him. Okay. McQuaid then picked up a gas-powered chop saw, brandished it, and threatened to cut the guy's head off. He tried to start the saw, but when the saw wouldn't start, and thank heavens it wouldn't start because who knows what would have happened, right? Instead, he put the saw back down, then picked up a rock and threw it at the guy, hitting him in the back, which means that the other guy was trying to walk away from him, right, if he was hit in the back with a rock, not threaten him, as McQuaid later claimed and still claims. McQuaid also still claims that he didn't throw the rock, although a police report at the time contradicts this, noting that the other guy had a mark on his back from being hit with a stone. Now, that's just what we need on the city council, right, is somebody that quick to anger and who is willing to stand up with a weapon in his hand and threaten to cut people's heads off. That's not exactly, that would not be good for negotiations on the city council.
Yeah, but he's a leader. He takes initiative.
Yeah, no. Anyway, so also in election news this week, within days of Lorena Gonzalez announcing that she is running for mayor, a deeply unqualified white male stepped into the race to challenge her and Colleen Echohawk. Art Langley, who appears to be running mostly on the reputation of his grandfather, who was a former city council member and Seattle mayor in the 1930s and then governor of Washington State in the 40s and 50s. Now, the elder Arthur Langley was a Republican and a conservative. In the 1930s, he belonged to the New Order of Cincinnatus, a Pacific Northwest party that was virulently anti-labor, anti-tax, and pro-police. And they were criticized, even at the time, for being proto-fascist in their operations, with a militaristic style of organization. The younger Art Langley, that's today's Art Langley, has no previous political experience and has made only very vague statements about what he would do as mayor, including things like accelerate reducing homelessness, clean up the city, focus on racial equity, maintain public safety, and help businesses get through the pandemic. And he hasn't provided...
I want a pony.
Right. He hasn't provided any details, and it's really hard to know what he means by statements like clean up the city. Even hearing focus on racial equity and maintain public safety in the same sentence kind of makes you wonder where he's been the past 5 years or the past 10 years. So I think the fact that the two leading candidates in the race for mayor are both women of color, Colleen Echohawk and Lorena Gonzalez, means that now every unqualified white guy in the city feels he's got a chance, and we'll probably see a few more jump into the race. There are now about a dozen candidates in the race for mayor.
It'll be two dozen by the time we're done.
Oh, yeah, with Echohawk and Gonzalez as the two leading candidates, and architect Andrew Grant Houston and Lance Randall of Seed in the third and fourth positions, at least when it comes to funding, although I think they're a distant third and fourth when it comes to name recognition. All of these candidates that I've mentioned today qualify for democracy vouchers, which people should have received in the mail this week or should be receiving soon if you haven't received them already. This will be the first time that Seattle voters can use democracy vouchers to help fund candidates for mayor and the two citywide council positions, 8 and 9. I mostly like to wait a little bit to see who else may jump into the race before I send my democracy vouchers. But don't wait too long. You know, I know the filing deadline is in May, but if you wait until midsummer to send your democracy vouchers along, you don't really have a chance to support these candidates when they're trying to get out there and get their names in people's minds. And that's going to be a lot harder this year.
Once we have the deadline for filing, it's really only a couple of months until the primary. So you've got a lot of people without name recognition who need the vouchers early on in order to be competitive in their races, which is the point of the vouchers, that you don't have to court big business and big money in order to compete.
Yeah, so if somebody excites you, send them your vouchers now. And if another person jumps into the race you find exciting, you can always send them cash later. But if you like somebody now and you think they're great, send them your vouchers. And if you don't receive yours in the mail, which is highly likely given the problems with the U.S. Post Office, some folks have seen delays of weeks when they've been sending out bill payments. You can go online to the Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission and you can claim your vouchers online there. So I would recommend doing that if you don't receive them in the next week or two.
Thank you, Louis DeJoy.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good sign that Joe Biden, President Biden, has said that he's going to fill the empty seats on the board that governs the U.S. Postal Service with Democrats.
Yeah, he announced the nomination this week. So assuming those nominations are approved, they will fire DeJoy and try and rebuild the post office.
Yeah, because I would hate to think that the Trump administration broke the U.S. Postal Service. It is one of the few public utilities that so many people rely on and that is such a great convenience.
Well, and as much damage as DeJoy and others have done to it during the last administration, this country has been gutting the post office for decades, so
yeah.
They have a ton of rebuilding to do.
Mostly there. Republicans in Congress cutting and cutting and cutting the budget for the U.S. Postal Service, so there's a lot of rebuilding that has to happen there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so back to local politics. Speaking of programs running out of money, the Just Care program is running out of money, but Mayor Durkin is refusing to help.
So for people who don't know, what is the Just Care program?
Yeah, the Just Care program has been using money from the King County budget to shelter about 100 of the highest needs homeless folks from the Pioneer Square and International District neighborhoods in local hotels. The program also provides them wraparound service for mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, legal assistance, job training and placement, et cetera. But that program will run out of money in March. The groups that run the program, including the Public Defender Association, the Asian Counseling and Referral Service, REACH, and the Chief Seattle Club, have been begging the city of Seattle to step up and apply for FEMA funds to cover at least the cost of the hotel rooms so that the program can continue. FEMA, under the new Biden administration, now has a program that will pay 100% of shelter costs for homeless folks at high risk for COVID-19, which all of the Just Care clients are at higher risk for COVID-19. And other cities have taken advantage of that FEMA program and been able to get almost, if not all of the expenses for similar programs covered by FEMA. So it's not difficult to get the funding. But Mayor Durkin's office has refused to apply for this grant, saying that Just Care is a King County program and not the city's responsibility. End of discussion. Never mind the program shelters homeless people from the streets in Seattle. Because the original funding came from King County, Mayor Durkin just won't lift a finger to help, even just to file some paperwork to get funding from the federal government.
So now, how is she spending her days? She sure doesn't seem to be doing anything these days.
Yeah. I think she's just kind of kicking back and saying, I only got a few months left, so I'm not doing anything. Now, her office has complained that the Just Care program is expensive, although the city isn't paying for it. Come on. And yes, Just Care is more expensive than other shelter services because it provides more services to a higher needs population. Duh. It's going to be more expensive. And think for a minute what's going to happen when that program runs out of money in March and those folks are abruptly kicked back onto the street. In a pandemic. And it will undo all the work that's been done so far to help them, right? If the federal government through FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is willing to provide funds to help address our homelessness emergency, remember, we declared it a city emergency some years back, right? Why would anyone turn away from that money, right? And I think it's because Durkin is heavily invested in getting the Regional Homelessness Agency to pick up the slack and do this kind of thing. But I want to point out that that agency so far has really failed to launch. And this week, the person who was selected to be the new CEO, I hate that title, the new CEO, Regina Cannon, has turned down the job and didn't give a reason why she's not going to step up and take that position. But, you know, I think we can come up with a few reasons. I think the foremost reason is the fact that Durkin negotiated an agreement that takes most of the power to decide the direction of the new agency out of the hands of Seattle, which is providing most of the funding for the agency and nearly all of its shelter space, and put it the majority of the decision making in the hands of suburban cities that have passed laws to criminalize homelessness. And the largest of those cities, including Bellevue, Renton, and Kent, along with five other smaller jurisdictions, have decided not to contribute to a countywide tax to convert unused motels into supportive shelter space. So that shows you where they're coming from. And many of those same municipalities have voted to ban shelters within their city limits. None of them will support safe consumption sites, and few are willing to fund drug treatment programs. So it appears that the regional agency is in limbo at the moment with no CEO, no staff, no set budget, and no policies. It's turning into, I think, the biggest failure of Jenny Durkin's administration, but she's still very wedded to the idea, and she won't fund or lift a finger to support new homelessness services while she still holds out hope for that regional agency. And I'm sorry to say, but I think we need to step back and say, okay, maybe Seattle needs to take those services back in-house.
The image that just came into my mind when you were talking about the agency is that big open pit that's across from Seattle City Hall that has been that way for like decades now.
It's been that way, yeah, for at least a decade.
Yeah. And not only does Seattle need to take those services back in-house, but they need to do it with an HSD director that's not openly hostile to the homelessness.
Yeah, and who's willing to actually kind of get off their rear and do something about it.
Which, again, underscores how important this mayoral election will be.
Mm-hmm.
And holding whoever is elected to the office to holding their feet to the fire in terms of getting serious about, we know some of the things that work in terms of ameliorating homelessness. But the city has been hostile to those policies for a number of years.
Yeah. And helping people to prevent people from falling into homelessness, not just rent subsidies, but things like law enforcement diversion programs, which Mayor Durkin has been completely hostile to. She's a former public prosecutor, so, she thinks people need to go to jail for every little infraction, I guess.
And addressing the city's serious housing crisis, which is a heavy contributor to homelessness.
Yeah. So let's move to talking about the state legislature and what do the rundown of bills. I have a lot of bills. So stop.
I got my pen ready. I got paper ready.
So stop me if I start going too long here. I just want to talk about some interesting bills that passed each chamber this week, starting with the House. In the House, House Bill 1044 would allow the Department of Corrections to put in place a college education program at state correctional facilities and provide assistance to prisoners who want to get a post-secondary degree. And it would provide special education opportunities for prisoners with learning disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and cognitive impairments. It's meant to be a way for prisoners to transition into civilian life. That's House Bill 1044 passed the House this week. House Bill 1070 expands the ability for local sales and use taxes for affordable housing, one of many bills that are meant to address the housing crisis in Washington State. It also allows that money to be used for transitional housing and supportive housing and services. It would also allow the use of revenue from the lodging tax to be used for housing homeless youth. That's House Bill 1070. Also passing the House is House Bill 1078, would restore voting rights to people convicted of felonies once they've been released from prison. I think we talked about that one last week. In other good news, House Bill 1083 also passed. It would provide additional assistance to people who are pushed out of mobile home parks and need to find alternative housing, something that's been a big contributor to homelessness among the poor in Washington State. House Bill 1109 would expand the rights of sexual assault victims, including referral to sexual assault programs and notification of the status of law enforcement investigations and prosecutions in their cases. House Bill 1336, also passed, would allow counties, smaller municipalities, utility districts, and port districts to provide telecommunication services to their residents as a public utility. We talked about this last week. This passed the House on the 23rd and was taken up in the Senate Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee on the 25th, so it's moving very quickly, and that's very encouraging to see, House Bill 1336. Now, House Bill 1329 would encourage municipalities to provide virtual access to governing body meetings and make recordings available for at least 6 months. They would also be required, smaller municipalities in the state would be required to state in their meeting minutes why they are excluding the public from an executive meeting. They would also be required to provide the opportunity for public comment, except in emergency situations, for all meetings. That's House Bill 1329, passed through the House and is on its way to the Senate. Second House, or substitute House Bill 1492, would extend unemployment benefits past the 52-week cutoff, part of COVID-19 relief. That also passed the House. And the final bill that I thought was interesting that passed the House this week was engrossed House Bill 1090, would ban the use of private prisons and detention facilities in Washington state, with some exceptions, including facilities for mental health treatment, drug treatment, and public health in cases of the need to quarantine. That passed the House on the 23rd and was taken up in the Senate Human Services Reentry and Rehabilitation Committee 2 days later. So it's moving swiftly, and that's the committee you want to keep track of in the Senate, the Human Services Reentry and Rehabilitation Committee, if you want this bill to move through the Senate. That would ban the use of private prisons in Washington state. So those are the bills of interest that passed through the House and are headed to the Senate or have already been picked up in the Senate. Now, the Senate's got a few more bills that passed that I thought were really interesting this week. Substitute Senate Bill 5003, the Living Donor Act, prohibits insurance companies from discriminating against living organ donors, typically people who donate a kidney, a lung, or a portion of their liver, pancreas, or intestine. Living organ donors also include people who donate other tissue, including skin for skin grafts, bone marrow for bone marrow transplants, or stem cells. Recognizing this as a supremely selfless act, the Senate passed this bill unanimously, and it's on its way to the House. So that's, again, substitute Senate Bill 5003. Very good bill, the Living Donor Act. Senate Bill 5030 would require school districts to develop comprehensive school counseling programs by the 22-23 school year. This passed the Senate on the 23rd and was taken up in the House Education Committee on Thursday. That's one that education advocates have been pushing for. Senate Bill 5180, that's Manka Dingra's bill to establish a process for folks to get criminal convictions vacated if those crimes resulted from the person being a victim of sex trafficking, prostitution, commercial, sexual abuse of a minor, sexual assault, or domestic violence. That bill passed the Senate on Wednesday, the 24th, and is on its way to the House. So that's good news. Senate Bill 5228 would address health inequities by requiring medical schools to train med students in a health equity program and work harder to bring students of color into their medical school programs, particularly at the University of Washington. That one also passed the Senate and is on its way to the House. Also passing the Senate is Bill 5235, which would prohibit local governments from imposing certain restrictions on rental housing and accessory dwelling units in an effort to expand affordable housing. Again, one of many bills that have been written this season for affordable housing. This one is moving along pretty swiftly. Also moving swiftly is 5313 would require health insurers and the state healthcare authority to cover gender-affirming medical treatments, a big plus and at the top of the list for transgender folks in Washington state. That one's on its way to the House. Senate Bill 5354 allows large cities to deploy a single civilian flagger to control traffic in an intersection without needing to have a police officer present. This also passed the Senate and is on its way to the House. Senate Bill 5066 requires police officers to intervene when they see a fellow officer use excessive force, to report wrongdoing to the officer's supervisor, and for police departments to adopt written policies on this requirement and provide training. This passed the Senate on the 23rd and was taken up just 2 days later in the House Public Safety Committee on Thursday. Very good sign that it may pass the legislature and be on the governor's desk soon.
And do you know if there's any organized opposition to that?
I'm assuming there may be some opposition, but I don't think it's organized. And I think it's pretty hard for officers' unions to argue that officers shouldn't be intervening when they see something that breaks their rules, you know?
Oh, I think that they're up to the challenge.
Yeah. I don't know. And you know, I haven't been sitting in on the committee hearings. I've only been looking at the bill reports afterwards, so I don't know what the opposition may be to some of these bills. I'm sure folks who are following them more closely would know the answer to that. Now, also in regards to police accountability, Senate Bill 5051 would establish a state licensing board for police in Washington state and would decertify officers who are fired for misconduct so they can't get a job in another police department in another city or county in Washington state. That passed the Senate on Thursday, the 25th, and is on its way to the House. Senate Bill 5119 would require the State Department of Corrections and local jails to convene a review team whenever an inmate dies unexpectedly, or the State Department of Ombuds requests a review of the death of an inmate. That also passed the Senate and is on its way to the House. And then two bills relating to the events of January 6th in Washington, D.C. and state capitals around the country have passed the Senate. Senate Bill 5148 and Senate Bill 5038. The first would make harassment of an election official a Class C felony, and the second would make the open carry of a firearm at any publicly permitted event or protest in the state or at the state capitol a gross misdemeanor. Both passed the Senate on Thursday and are headed to the House. There is some opposition, particularly to the second bill, because from folks who are big on supporting the Second Amendment right to bear arms. So it'll be interesting to see whether that second one in particular, Senate Bill 5038, passes the House.
Yeah, the right to brandish arms against an elected official does not seem to be covered by the Second Amendment.
No, it doesn't, does it? Now, what they're objecting to mostly is the right to bear arms at publicly permitted events. The open carry right is I think the premier right for some people in living in Washington state. All other rights under the Constitution appear to be secondary to that one. So we'll see if that one makes it through the House. Now, Senate Bill 5432, which passed the Senate this week, would create the Office of Cybersecurity within the state's Office of the Chief Information Officer, essentially the state's IT department, and would require each department of the state government to adopt security standards. That one passed the Senate unanimously on Wednesday and is on its way to the House. And then Senate Bill 5055, which would standardize disciplinary processes across the state for all police departments, passed the Senate. That bill is the one in which the state would keep a list of 9 arbitrators to be assigned in alphabetical order to hear disciplinary cases. No local laws or union contracts would be able to change or modify the system. And it would prohibit any collective bargaining agreement that would overturn any city or county law that sets up a civilian review board or process. That passed the Senate on Wednesday, February 18th, and has already been taken up in the House Labor and Workplace Standards Committee. Now, it's key that it's in the House Labor and Workplace Standards Committee. It could die there, or it could be altered quite a bit, depending on how responsive the committee members are to protests from some labor groups that this bill cuts into the rights of labor unions. So I think it's important that people contact the members of the House Labor and Workplace Standards Committee and let them know what you think about the bill.
And which bill was that again?
That is substitute Senate Bill 5055 to stand.
Yeah, and it's in that committee because attempts by cities to change standards in in that kind of thing have run into police union objections that impact has to be negotiated with the unions because it impacts our working conditions.
Yeah, and other labor unions have raised objections to some of the provisions of that bill because they think it could, it's a slippery slope. Once you do that to one labor union, the state can do it to others. So it's interesting to see what those objections are, to hear people address those objections, and it would be interesting to see who the members of that committee are and how responsive they are to those objections. But if you support the bill and want to see it passed, or if you're interested in looking at that bill and you might have objections to it, you can go to the state legislature's website, which is leg.wa.gov. You can click on bill information on the left side of the screen to look up bills by their bill number or subject matter. On the main page, you'll see a list of committees that are meeting today. And if you click on a committee, it'll take you to that committee's page where you can sign up to testify or watch the committee hearing online. You have to sign up to testify at least an hour before a committee hearing starts. Again, that website is leg.wa.gov.
Thank you, Clementine.
Anyway, so I do encourage people, if any of these bills sounded interesting to you, to look them up, read the text, and become informed, and then listen to the committee hearing meetings and or testify. Let your legislators know.
The state legislator's website is really remarkably helpful. I would encourage people to check it out.
Check it out, use it, and get involved.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, anything else on that?
Nope.
No, let's move on.
Let's move on to this week's developments with the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, there have been a few. Jay Inslee on Thursday said that none of the 8 regions in the state's reopening plan will fall back to phase 1. They're all in phase 2 right now. And he said they will remain that way for several weeks. This, of course, in the possibility we're hearing from public health officials that the current decline in new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths may not last. We're seeing more and more of the state reporting new variants, either the British one or for this week for the first time in King County. Virus sequencers identified somebody who was suffering from the South African variant. We don't know anything more about that person, especially what their travel history is, but it is potentially now in the community along with the British variant.
And I'll be talking a little bit more about those variants here when job is done.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead and do that now.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of do a quick rundown of the variants, because that's been in the news quite a bit this week, but not a whole lot of information about each variant. The California variant that I want to talk about is proving to be more contagious than early COVID-19 strains. 2 studies this week showed that this strain, which they're calling B1.427/429, produces twice as many viral particles inside a person's body as the other earlier variants do. This has the effect of increasing that a person's viral load, which means it may be making some people sicker than other variants do. And in addition, the doubling of viral particles means that people sick with this variant are more contagious and able to spread the disease, which is why it's rapidly spreading in California. In addition, the new variant is better at evading the human immune system and can evade antibodies from people who've already recovered from other variants of COVID-19 and people who've been vaccinated. It is at least 40% more effective at infecting human cells than earlier variants. And, of course, it is now the predominant strain in California since it arose in September.
We also saw unconfirmed reports that are being challenged by city officials that up to 25% of New York City's recent infections are from a variant that's similar to the California variant.
Yeah, so I'll get one, to that.
It's one to keep an eye on. Yeah.
Yeah. Secondly, I wanted to talk about the British variant, which they're calling B.1.1.7, is extremely contagious and spreads extremely rapidly, faster than the California variant. It has spread to over 90 countries around the world. Cases are doubling in the United States about every 9 days now. It is also deadlier than previous variants, approximately 30 to 70% deadlier, according to recent data from Britain. Here in the U.S., the B.1.1.7 variant was first detected in Colorado in December, and it's now in at least 45 states, possibly all 50. And it's expected to become the dominant strain throughout the U.S. by the end of March, just 1 month from now. So that's extremely fast. Although it could collide with the California variant on the West Coast and cause a higher spike in cases here, it wouldn't necessarily supplant the California variant. Instead, we'd have two very rapidly spreading and more deadly viruses here on the West Coast, a double whammy. Now, if you're offered a vaccine, I would have to say at this point, you know, just hearing about these two variant forms, you should take it, regardless of what the vaccine is. You know, the difference in efficacy between the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is going to be approved this weekend, and the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines is not measurable enough to matter. You know, if I'm offered the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I'll take it, and I'll take it as quickly as I can get it, which at this rate, it's looking like it may not be till fall or winter.
Yeah. Now, and I'll talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine when we get to the national news.
Yeah. Now, third, the New York variant, which Jav mentioned earlier, which they're calling B.1.526, first arose in November and is already making up at least 25% of new infections in New York. It is gaining ground rapidly.
New York City specifically.
Yeah, this variant contains two mutations, one that affects the spike protein in a way that might help it evade the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, and the other allows it to bind more tightly to human cells, like the California variant. The first variant has been seen in other variants around the world, including the South Africa and Brazil variants, which I'll talk about now. The Brazil variant, which they're calling the P1 variant, contains a large number of mutations, 17 to be exact, including three mutations to the spike protein, which means that people who've had COVID-19 already could be vulnerable to infection from the Brazil variant. It arose in Brazil in December. The number of COVID infections there exploded, and it's already spread to multiple countries, including the U.S. It's too soon to say if the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines will still be effective or less effective against the P1 variant, because we haven't seen many cases here quite yet, or ones that have been at least identified yet. But it appears to be an extremely contagious variant that is very worrying. Now, the South African variant, B.1.351, has the same mutations in the spike protein as the Brazil variant. So if we look at the South Africa variant, we can get some clues as to how the Brazil variant will behave. At least one of those mutations allows it to evade the antibodies produced by the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is why the AstraZeneca vaccine is not being used in South Africa anymore. And the E484K mutation to the spike protein in this variant means that the virus doesn't respond to the current monoclonal antibody treatments that are the best treatments available right now for severe COVID-19 infection. This makes both the Brazil and the South African strains extremely concerning to health officials, not just because they're very contagious, not just because people who've already been sick with COVID-19 could get them again and get sick again, but also because we don't have good treatments for them if you get extremely ill. Both of these two variants have been found in the U.S. The first cases arose in late January, but they don't appear to be spreading quite as quickly as the California, New York, and British variants, which have been here longer. But I think it's just a matter of time. And, you know, we really don't know for sure about how widespread some of these variants are, because we need more testing and we need more genetic sequencing. Those efforts are just expanding and getting underway now, 1 year after the start of the pandemic, because the Biden administration is prioritizing it, whereas the Trump administration didn't. So researchers here in the U.S. are pretty much already making plans about making changes in the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines to adjust for these new variant strains like the Brazil, South Africa, and California strains that could evade antibodies produced by those vaccines. In the meantime, I think your best defense is get vaccinated when it's offered to you, but continue to cover your face, wash your hands, practice social distancing, because that's your best defense against some of these strains.
Yeah, and because we don't have good data yet on how liable vaccine recipients are to continuing to spread the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, wash your hands, wear a mask, you know, all social distance, all that stuff. We
yeah.
know what works. We just have to be disciplined enough to do it.
Yeah, we just have to do it. Okay, Job, did you want to talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Yeah, I want to talk about some national developments. First of all, late last night, the House passed Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, which contains a lot of different things, including a $1,400 checks and a $10, $15 an hour minimum wage for national federal standard.
The Senate parliamentarian said that
I was getting to that.
Okay.
So it moves to the Senate now. The Democrats were counting on being able to pass this package from the House with 50 votes through something called the reconciliation process, which is typically a tool that's used to reconcile budgets that for whatever reasons in the Senate only requires 50 rather than 60 votes. It cannot be filibustered. The Senate parliamentarian ruled that because the House package includes the minimum wage provision, it cannot be passed with a reconciliation process. That enables Republicans to filibuster it to death.
Or else the Senate Democrats will have to drop the $15 minimum hour provision out of the bill.
Yeah, and there have been a number of proposals for how they might get around the Senate parliamentarian's rule, and or ignore it, and try to pass it with 50 votes. One would be to, separate out the minimum wage provision as a separate bill, in which case it almost certainly would pass the Senate parliamentarian's muster and be able
but
to
would
pass.
Pass the Senate because the Republicans would filibuster it, right?
Well, no. what I'm saying is that it's possible that they could pass that separately with only the 50 votes. But, you know, that
no,
has
I
not
think because it's Yeah, I think it's because it's attached to this spending bill that is considered a budget bill, which is why it's not subject to the filibuster. And once they separate it out, it wouldn't be. So then
they would have to attach it to something like the defense spending bill or some other bill that's considered essential.
Yeah, which always passes.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. And those kind of bills very commonly have, provisions attached to them by one party or another that they know would never pass otherwise. So that's a fairly common tactic. There was also a proposal by Senator Bernie Sanders to change the tax code to penalize companies that don't pay $15 an hour. Now, that would partially solve the problem, but there are a number of jobs, for instance, rideshare drivers, things like that, would not be affected under that because those people are not considered employees. They're contractors.
Well, and they do what's considered piecework.
Yeah.
Some folks have argued that being paid in the old piecework way is almost certain to violate minimum wage laws anyway. So
yeah, because you know, the gig economy didn't exist when those kind of rules were written.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why companies pay their workers in that way is to get around workplace standards and you know, be able to pay them less.
And fair pay, yeah.
Yes. So anyway, that is under process now, and it's in the Senate's up to the Senate to pass it, which obviously the administration wants to do that quickly. And then let's talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that was approved by a key FDA panel yesterday after on Wednesday. The company put data out showing that it was 84% effective against the vaccine. And this is a vaccine that has several distinct advantages. One is that it only requires one shot rather than two. The second is that it can be stored at room temperature rather than having to be refrigerated or deep frozen, as with the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, respectively.
Yeah. So, and if it is refrigerated, it lasts for months in the refrigerator, not just a few hours.
So this is something that the FDA is expected to approve this weekend, and it should start shipping to states on Monday. Now, Johnson & Johnson says that it has 4 million doses that it can start shipping immediately. So this is going to be a major boost to the supplies of vaccine in different states, which have been a problem with vaccine rollout. Although this week we saw the Biden administration claim that they had administered 50 million doses in only 5 weeks, their first 37 days of being in office. The original goal of the Biden administration was 100 million doses in 100 days. So they're halfway there in only a little over a third of the time, which is really pretty impressive, particularly since when they got into office, they discovered that the Trump administration did not have any kind of a plan for rollout or distribution of the vaccines, because they couldn't be bothered, honestly. So it's moving quickly. And we will see a massive increase in all likelihood in the number of available doses. I believe Washington State said they've already been earmarked for 60,000 doses to arrive next week. So
yeah, now I've been hearing from people that that they want to wait for the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine because they don't think the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is effective enough. And I just want to address that for a second. Now, if you look at the effectiveness of other vaccines, like let's take, for example, the flu shot. In a good year, a quad flu, which contains four flu strains, quad flu shot is effective about 66 to 70% of the time, depending on your age. For younger people, it's less effective than for older people. But the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine, by comparison, is 84 to 85% effective in preventing severe COVID-19. And that is really, really good. Okay. And the 9 to 10% difference between that and two doses of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine is not measurable enough to make a difference, in my opinion. You know, and in addition, the number of people who've been able to get both shots of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine is still so small that if I'm offered the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I will take it, and I'll probably take it before I would take the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, because I think there is a possibility, I don't know this for sure, that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine may make you less sick in the 2 or 3 days after you get it than the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine does.
Yeah, there have been very mixed reports and people's reaction to the vaccine. There have been remarkably few allergic reactions to it, but in terms of like soreness of muscles or around the injection area,
fatigue, some, and nausea, yeah, and some, all that some, kind of stuff.
Some people have no problems at all, and some people do. So.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that the Biden administration was taking steps this week to address data that's been coming out showing the serious disparity between communities of color and vulnerable communities for the virus and more privileged communities in terms of who has access to the vaccines and who has access to preventative measures. So the Biden administration announced, for example, that it is shipping 35 million masks to be distributed free to people who were at risk of the virus in community centers and food banks. So targeting homeless populations, communities of color, et cetera, with access to those kind of resources. This is the kind of thing that should have been done a year ago, right? But it wasn't. So now it's being done. And now the Biden administration is having to figure out how to make these kind of resources available. They've also taken a lot of steps to make PPEs available to frontline workers and other communities that were not prioritized when they went to hospitals in previous shipments. So a lot of progress is being made. The federal government is having to do a lot of different things at once. But again, these are largely things that should have been done a year ago, but were not.
Well, and it's nice to see somebody trying instead of just telling the states you're all on your own. You can, you know, compete against each other on the open market for these supplies because we're not going to help.
And, you know, a year ago this week was when Donald Trump reassured us that the virus was under control, that there was only 15 cases and it will be no cases soon because it's going to go away like a miracle. That was a year ago and over a half a million deaths ago. It's nice to see a federal government that actually cares. And I was going to say something that is not radio appropriate. gives a dot, dot, dot. So, these are all encouraging signs, but the variants, as Maria was describing, are still a serious concern and have been a serious concern in countries around the world.
Yeah, and they're only a concern because the idiots in the who are advising the Trump administration were talking about let's just let it run wild in the human population and develop herd immunity. You know, when you let a virus run wild into the human population, you get mutations and you get these more deadly variants arising.
Yeah, you get a lot of mutations, and some of them are invariably going to be bad for people.
Oh, yeah.
So, Job, what about the rest of the world? Are they seeing any improvements or things getting
worse? It varies depending on the country. Things are getting worse, certainly in countries that have been wrestling with variants, like the U.K., South Africa, Brazil. Brazil right now is in really bad shape, even though President Jair Bolsonaro, who pretty much worships Donald Trump, was railing against masks and saying that they harm children, et cetera, et cetera, on the same day that the country set a new record for deaths on Thursday. Their deaths are rising. They're about to pass India for the second worst number of cases in the world as well. The UK and Russia have both passed 4 million cases confirmed recently. The US, of course, is up to 28 million cases, which tells you how much of a disparity there's been between the rest of the world and us. The number of cases in the US is starting to flatten, but it's, still, the variants are of concern, and it looks like from the data that communities that have had more vaccinations, like healthcare centers, the senior living, et cetera, their numbers of cases are dropping dramatically. So that's a very good sign that the vaccinations are working, and the faster we can get more people vaccinated, the better. At this point. And that's true in the rest of the world as well. Countries that have had high vaccination rates, like Israel, for example, and in the UK, are starting to see their case numbers flatten, even with the variants. So that's encouraging news, but there's a lot of countries that have not had access to vaccines yet because they're poorer countries. And the WHO and other global organizations are trying to address that. We saw vaccines rolled out thanks to a WHO program for the first time in Ghana and Ivory Coast in Africa this week. And other countries are scheduled to receive those vaccines soon or starting to receive those vaccines. So So the world is starting to see improvement, but it's still a very serious problem in a lot of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Just a couple minutes left this week. Marked a noticeable change, at least amongst the left, with their perception of the Biden administration with the bombing in Syria.
Yeah, it was right on the Syrian border with Iraq, and it was in retaliation for Iranian-backed paramilitaries attacking U.S. military installations in the Middle East. We saw really a sea change in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East as a whole this week. The bombing was only one part of that. We also saw talks between Joe Biden and King Salman in Saudi Arabia. And what was noticeable about that was not so much what Joe Biden said. According to Saudi Arabia aides to the king, who is 85 years old and has had a number of health problems, barely retained any of the conversation. What was notable is who Biden did not talk to, who was MBS, who's the crown prince, who's second in line to the
Mohammed bin Salman.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Second in line to the Saudi monarchy, and who has been effectively running the country for the past several years, and who, of course, had very cozy relationships with Donald Trump and with Jared Kushner and with Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. The day after Biden talked with the king, he released the report that the Trump administration had suppressed on what the U.S. intelligence agencies had found about the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who was the Washington Post columnist who was murdered and then dismembered at a Saudi consulate in Istanbul a couple of years ago. The intelligence agency reports were even more damning than was publicly anticipated. They directly laid the blame for the ordering of that murder at
Mohammed bin Salman's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They directly blamed him for that.
They said that he signed off on it, okayed the operation to murder Khashoggi.
Yeah. So that was released, which is certainly a sea change in U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia, although Biden pointedly said that he would not cut off U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia. So effectively, you know, no sanctions or anything like that. So effectively, there really still isn't a price that he paid with U.S. relations for that murder. We also saw this week was the 7th anniversary of Russian annexation of Crimea, and Biden released a statement standing with Ukraine and saying that territory does properly belong to Ukraine, even though it's been in Russian hands for the last 7 years. So we're seeing, of course, Russia has a lot of different interests, especially in Syria. It has a big naval base there. It is trying to put a pipeline through there. So
has more troops there than we do. I think the Trump administration pulled the U.S. presence in Syria down to maybe 1,000 advisors.
Russia is now a major player in Middle East relations because of the lack of action in the Trump administration and, you know, basically Vladimir Putin getting to do whatever he wanted in a lot of different parts of the world, particularly in the Middle East. You know,
it'll be interesting to see how the Biden administration responds to that. Is it going to be increasing U.S. presence there, or is it going to be trying to feel their way to figure out who our allies are? You know,
I think it's more the latter, but, you know, I don't have a lot of trust because Joe Biden has a lot of history, particularly his years in the Senate, of being very hawkish. And, you know, one of the failings of the American foreign policy in the Middle East has been, you know, relying on sanctions, on military power, and on, you know, diplomacy that does not succeed because they don't have a lot of credibility as a neutral arbiter.
And these long-running wars of occupation, like the war in Iraq.
Yeah, the invasion of Iraq did a lot to destabilize the Middle East in a lot of different complicated ways that are still playing out.
Oh, yeah.
The Biden people are going to try to have to navigate that. And then on top of that, deal with the damage that was caused during the Trump years.
Yeah.
We will talk to you both, or potentially you both, next week.
Next week.
Sounds good.